coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Dover International Speedway celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, a history that includes a golden era when Sunday crowds topped 100,000 on NASCAR weekends.
They just started adding grandstand seats, and the capacity of the stadium just grew and grew for 15 consecutive years, and those seats were filled just about every time.
Contributor Larry Nagyas trades pit road for memory lane as he looks the Monster Mile, then, now, and beyond. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also head to UD's Star Campus to learn more about research using virtual reality to help identify and solve balance issues. And our latest arts playlist looks at preservation efforts at the Rehoboth Art League. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The roar of race car engines is back in the first state this week as Dover International Speedway hosts its spring NASCAR weekend. But this year is a bit different for the Monster Mile. 2019 marks 50 years of NASCAR racing at the Dover track. The ride started with the Mason-Dixon 300 on July 6, 1969. And since then, the one-mile oval has seen its share of highs and lows, largely mirroring NASCAR's trajectory through the years. This week, contributor Larry Nagyas charts the track's history and takes a peek at what lies ahead in his piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he and I recently sat down to discuss it all. So let's go back to the beginning of 50 years ago. The thing that always strikes me as curious is how did Dover wind up with a racetrack? At the time, 50 years ago, NASCAR was predominantly a Southern sport.
Well, yeah, it certainly was. And Dover, when you think about it, was really pretty much a dream come true for three men who had, you know, really larger than life personalities and an incredible ability to get things done. Let's talk about who they were. First of all, it was Dave Buxton, who was a Middletown native who would move into Kent County, and he became a Republican Party political leader, and he served the state both as Attorney General and Lieutenant Governor, and he also had a tremendous fondness for horses. Second, there was Melvin Joseph, who was a big-time Sussex County contractor who later became known for financing an expedition that discovered a sunken Spanish treasure ship off the Florida Keys. And he was the auto racing fan. And then there was John Rollins, Big John, who moved up from Georgia, opened a Ford dealership in Lewis, and really became, for his time, a very successful serial entrepreneur. He was the finance guy. So what happened here was that Buxton drew up the plan. He was looking at the idea of having a horse racing track inside the larger oval for the auto racing track. Mel Joseph built the structure, and John Rollins did everything he possibly could, including covering some of the debts in those early years to make sure that it became profitable.
And there was a time early on that the horses were bigger than the cars, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when the track opened, as you mentioned, NASCAR was essentially a Southern sport. Horse racing was pretty much the only legal gambling option around. You know, and so at the start, Dover offered both thoroughbred and harness racing. The thoroughbreds didn't last long, about 4 or 5 years. The opening of big tracks in larger urban areas, like the Meadowlands outside New York City, took care of that. Now, harness racing was originally so popular in Dover that it wasn't unusual for 30 or 40 busloads of fans to arrive in Dover on snowy Sunday afternoons in January and February. And I mean, it is really amazing. But what's happening here was that Delaware was one of the few states and the only one in the area that allowed Sunday racing. So after a while, the other states caught on. They legalized racing on Sunday. Off-track betting came in, and simulcasting, and all of these things combined to make going to the track less essential. And you know, in terms of, you know, if you wanted to bet on the horses, you could bet on the horses just about anywhere. You didn't have to go to Dover to bet on the horses racing in Dover. And the harness racing just gradually fell off. And as harness racing faded. Now, of course, there still is racing the horses at Dover, but as the popularity of harness racing fell down, NASCAR influence started to grow.
At the time, it was kind of fortuitous, I guess, for the track. And in your piece, you note that current Dover Motorsport president and CEO Dennis McGlynn points to kind of what he calls kind of a turning point, a moment he feels that made NASCAR and Dover really take off. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, okay, it was February in 1979, and this was at a time when the Super Bowl was still held in January, so the football season was a little bit shorter. There was a lot less in the way of options for sports fans in the middle of winter. And this particular weekend in February of 79, there was a massive snowstorm that blanketed the East Coast. So pretty much if you wanted to get your sports fix that particular Sunday, what you had to do was watch the Daytona 500, which was NASCAR's signature race. And that race delivered plenty of excitement that year. Cale Yarborough and Donnie Allison were racing for the lead on the final lap, and then they crashed into each other at just shortly before hitting the finish line. And that allowed Richard Petty to sneak in and claim the prize and win first place. And then as the race ended, Allison and Yarborough got into it in the infield and got into a massive fist fight, a hockey type brawl, and Donnie Allison's brother Bobby even got into it as well, and it was quite a scene. And this just instantly, as far as McGlynn was concerned, expanded NASCAR's fan base. Suddenly, Dennis McGlynn had a much easier time marketing this southern sport north of the Mason-Dixon line, and Dover was pretty much on its way. And shortly after that, they just started adding grandstand seats, and the capacity of the stadium just grew and grew for 15 consecutive years, and those seats were filled just about every time. Add more seats, and more people came to fill them up.
I was going to say, I mean, this was a period really from that point on that was kind of, as you mentioned, kind of a 15-year golden era for NASCAR and for NASCAR in Dover. For those who may not remember, can you kind of outline just how big racing actually got here in the first state and why it built up to such a big thing for a while?
Well, I first of all, look at what NASCAR had at the time. They had an incredible group of drivers. They were highly competitive, and they had strong personalities that enabled them to build rabid fan bases. You know, you look at the people who won at Dover in the 80s and into the 90s. You've got names like Bobby Allison, Richard Petty, Bill Elliott, Dale Earnhardt, Rusty Wallace, Kyle Petty. Between 1980 and 1995, these guys just monopolized the NASCAR circuit and all did well at Dover. And then in the late 90s comes Jeff Gordon, who would win four races at Dover. And he was especially popular in Delaware because the DuPont Company was one of his major sponsors. And now if you look at this period, especially as you go into the 90s and move forward, DuPont is a prime sponsor through Gordon and MBNA, later Bank of America, but MBNA at this time was also the prime sponsor of the races at Dover. So you had the state's two largest businesses putting their muscle and their sponsorship behind what was going on. So in addition to all the fans for drivers like Allison and Gordon and so on coming out to the races, you also had this tremendous corporate support, which meant that Delaware residents who worked for these big companies were also going to the races.
And perhaps the most memorable race, and maybe the high watermark for NASCAR in Dover, came in September 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, again, the race weekend fell just a week and a half after the 9/11 attacks. And now, pro football games, Major League Baseball, the NASCAR race in New Hampshire for that Sunday immediately following the attacks, all of that had been canceled. So this weekend, when the race in Dover was scheduled, was really the resumption of big-time daytime sports activities across the country. You know, and Dover was, it was a particularly intense situation here. Now remember, the remains from the victims of the plane crash at the Pentagon were taken to the mortuary at Dover Air Force Base for identification. You know, and Dennis McGlynn recalls there were constant communications throughout that race week with the FBI, with the Secret Service, with all sorts of federal and state security and police agencies. He was telling me that they were getting reports of, you know, suspicious-looking people who were registering at hotels in Wilmington and, you know, down near the Rehoboth area, presumably with an interest in the race. But, you know, the level of suspicions there, security was at red alert levels. And, you know, then you take it the step further and you get closer to the race. NASCAR has never been short on patriotic demonstrations. So MBNA, which was the race sponsor, and the Dover Downs people got together and they bought American flags that they handed out to all the spectators as they arrived for the Sunday race. Now the 135,000 fans that showed up that day, that was the all-time attendance record at Dover. And these folks waved their flags and they were hungry for a good time. So, and you know, this is how Dennis McGlynn put it to me. He said, they were chanting, USA, USA, USA. They were doing the wave. They were pounding on the grandstand. It was electrifying. And to be able to pull it off, it was a great thing. And then, to top it all off, the race was won by Dale Earnhardt Jr. just 9 months after his father had been killed in a fiery crash at Daytona.
It was a remarkable weekend, and a lot of people forget. I mean, at that point, again, 135,000 fans. You mentioned, like, you know, NFL had restarted, baseball restarted, but this was probably that weekend the biggest event in terms of people. So the security piece was really kind of scary.
Yeah, most definitely was. Really, just hard to remember until you talk to the folks who were right there, you know, exactly how intense that situation was. I remember other components of this revival after 9/11. You know, I'm the security in New York when baseball resumed with a game between the Yankees and the Mets, and that same sort of intensity. But to see this and to see this essentially the largest sporting event in the country that weekend occurring in Dover, really amazing.
But through the 2000s, things always started to cool off for NASCAR and Dover. Why and just how far have things now fallen off?
Well, this growth that NASCAR had and that Dover had, I mean, it just wasn't going to last forever. But what really clobbered it was the recession of 2008. One of the first things that happens during an economic downturn is that the big companies trim their marketing budgets. And, you know, in Dover's case, that meant a loss of sponsorship revenue. I mean, you know, when we talked about MBNA, which by then was Bank of America, but them and heaven knows how many others were involved. But for Dover, the sponsorship revenue meant losing about 20,000 seats being filled each year. That these are people that the sponsor that would bring in their key clients and their top employees and so on. And there was really no easy way to make up for that loss. Why was that? Because NASCAR has this largely blue-collar fan base, and the recession puts so many of them out of work. So attendance was dropping. There's no longer a need for 135,000 seats, and having all those empty seats weren't going to look good on television with all these NASCAR races now being televised. So Dover officials gradually pared the size of the grandstand, and now the capacity there is about 85,000.
But this wasn't really a death knell for racing here, and that's really for a couple of reasons. The first has to do with NASCAR's business model. Can you explain how the business model has kind of kept that drop in attendance from really being a fatal blow?
Well, and look back, and we mentioned the Dover Daytona 500 back in 1979, and how that brought the NASCAR brand into the consciousness of sports fans in the North. You know, and then you think about the growth of cable television in that era. You've got ESPN coming on board, and then there were other networks, the Nashville Network, most prominently, that featured this blend of country music and sports. sports car racing. So you've got both of those things going on. So NASCAR booms, so does its television revenue. Over the long term, this is going to mean that tracks didn't always have to be filled with fans, because as long as they're watching on television, the networks are going to reward NASCAR with lucrative contracts, and the racetracks always got a piece of that revenue pot.
And simultaneously, Dover Speedway has made some changes as well. What have they done to compensate, so both in the racing realm and otherwise, to kind of maintain a viable business model?
Well, with fewer seats, Dover has worked to become far more fan-friendly. Having fewer seats has made this a lot easier. I mean, you know, when you think about it, you know, when you had 135,000 people packed in there, there wasn't a whole lot that you could do special for them. You know, you give them their seats and they're happy. But you know, with fewer fans, you can do more things. And so, take a look at, you know, like this weekend in particular. But you know, they've already installed a fan zone. They've got lots of exhibits and interactive programming, things like that for kids to do. And now this weekend, 50th anniversary celebration, they're going to have Q&A sessions with NASCAR drivers. They're going to have country music concerts, a big barbecue, a movie showing, fireworks, performances by the micro wrestlers and the Harlem Globetrotters. And then let's not forget about the food. You know, NASCAR fans have been known for, you know, as a hot dogs, burgers, and fry crowd, and, you know, give them a soda and a couple of beers to wash it down, and that's pretty much what they were looking for. But, you know, this year, guests are going to be able to sample lagers created by craft brewers in Delaware, and they're going to be able to sample sandwiches, snacks, and other treats created by Sodell Concepts, which is well known for the group of restaurants that it operates in the Rehoboth area. As for the otherwise part of your question, well, back in 2012, Dover became home to Firefly, a new rock music festival that has been running for 3 or 4 days in late June now. Firefly has grown to become really the premier rock festival in the Northeast, and it's one of the more popular in the country. Now, it's not what you'd expect for a business focused on auto and harness racing to get into, but it does show that this track management is willing to try something new. But first, it carefully examines the risk-to-reward ratio before deciding where it's going.
Certainly with Firefly, the reward has certainly been there for Dover International Speedway. So what are the track's expectations now for race weekends and kind of going forward? What do they expect they'll be doing business-wise over the next 10, 15 years?
Well, again, let's go back to Firefly and put this in perspective, because it's a very interesting perspective. As we mentioned, you know, in NASCAR's glory days, you'd have 135,000 fans turning out for a Sunday race. Now, Firefly has become Dover's primary attraction. That brings in 90,000 to 95,000 music lovers for a 3-day weekend. The expectation for Dover for a race weekend now is somewhere in the mid-40s range for each of the two Sunday races. So you add it up. The two Sunday races combined just about matches what you're getting for Firefly. Really, you know, an incredible turnaround transition. Now, this year, because it's the 50th anniversary, Dennis McGlynn thinks that the crowds could be bigger. He's not quite sure how much bigger, but, you know, we're still talking, okay, instead of 40 to 45 or so, maybe you get up to 50, maybe you get a little over 50. It's not going to be anywhere near like it was 15 to 20 years ago. So now you fast forward a little bit. So where are we going to go? All this extra entertainment and all the activities surrounding the races, I mean, they're designed to do a couple of things. First of all, keep the current fan base interested, but more importantly, to try to draw more new fans to the track. They want to bring in the millennials and get the younger generation excited about races. But, you know, they're still dealing with the fact that there are thousands of different ways for people to spend their leisure time. You know, back in the day, there were, you know, maybe 10 television stations, and now there's, you know, there's hundreds of channels to deal with. And the number of entertainment options outside of the media has also multiplied. So it's quite a challenge for Dover and for NASCAR. But now you got, you know, keep in mind they do have this revenue model currently that relies heavily on television contracts. So it, I mean, it's not absolutely essential that every last seat will be filled. So you look down the road, and where does this all take you? Well, you know, you've got the internet, you've got people watching the races on their phones now. You've got developments with virtual reality where, you know, who knows, you know, McGlynn is talking about, you know, you put on the virtual reality glasses and you pay $5 and you're able to watch, not just watch the race, but put yourself on the track and virtually racing around the track with the drivers. The possibilities here are still, they're imaginable, but in some extent beyond your imagination as well.
And do they see any additional expansion beyond racing and Firefly? Other things that they can do at the property?
Well, I'm going to say yes, but it's a kind of an iffy sort of situation. A couple of years ago, Dover explored the possibility of hosting the annual Punkin' Chunkin' competition on the first weekend in November. But not only was the track itself too small to accommodate these mechanized gourd tossers, but, you know, so was the Woodlands, the area where Firefly is held. You know, and logistically, they tell me the only way it would have worked would have been if they had been blasting pumpkins and having them catapult over Route 1. But, you know, you've got some risks of a misfire here, and that was just a little too great for them to consider. That said, you know, the preparation for the races is pretty intense for a month or so in advance. So depending upon how NASCAR builds its schedule, you know, the only times open for a big event now would be late October, early November, and possibly in April. And in both those time frames, you know, weather is always an issue, and there are, you know, certainly lots of other established events nationwide, particularly in the springtime. So Dover's management's fair to say, you know, they're looking for ideas. They haven't latched on to one yet. You know, and you and I were talking the other day about the grandstand possibly becoming a stop for touring rock and country music acts, and but then again, established performers might not want to take a shot at a venue here that doesn't have a track record, shall we say, for, you know, producing large-scale concerts. Lots of people would like to see Dover get more use, but, you know, as you tell, you know, we're not quite sure what that might be. But then again, you know, 8 years ago, Firefly was a big surprise to all of us. So, you know, who knows? Maybe they've got, another big surprise up their sleeves.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. You can find his piece on Dover International Speedway's 50th anniversary online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, we head to the University of Delaware's Star Campus to learn about research incorporating virtual reality with the help of UD intern contributor DJ McCauley. Stay tuned for that here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We've told you in the past, we like to highlight student journalism on The Green, whether it's high schoolers in our Generation Voice youth media program at Mount Pleasant and McCain High Schools, or college students at the University of Delaware and Delaware State University. This spring, we have a UD intern, DJ McCauley, focusing on science and health reporting, and she's produced a terrific piece on the Control of Balance and Locomotion Lab at the University of Delaware's Star Campus. It examines that lab's use of a virtual reality cave to study balance issues in people ranging from healthy older adults to people suffering from Parkinson's disease and concussions. You can find DJ's piece right now at DelawarePublic.org, and she set up an interview with Jacqueline Cassis, a postdoctoral researcher in UD's Department of Kinesiology and Applied Physiology, working at the lab. I recently visited Cassis there to chat about the lab's work and the VR cave.
Give us a sense of what kind of work you're doing here
in this lab?
Sure. So our lab studies how people use sensory information to balance. So sensory systems like your vision, so seeing with your eyes. We also have an inner ear balance system called your vestibular system. And then the third sensory system we use for balance is our proprioception or our somatosensory system. So that's kind of like sensors in your muscles and joints that tell your body where it's positioned in space. And so we try to understand how both healthy individuals and neurological populations use different sensory systems to balance. So for example, we'll have people walking on our treadmill, and while they're walking, we'll try and disturb their vision. So we'll do things like rotate the scene as they walk. And this will give us an idea of how they're using that visual information to balance. And like I said, both in healthy individuals and then some of the neurological populations we work with include healthy older adults, people following head injury or concussion, people with Parkinson's disease, children with cerebral palsy. Those are the majority of the work that we're doing right now fall under those headings.
So we're in the virtual reality VR cave. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of, first of all, what the VR cave is and how it kind of works overall?
Yeah, so you may be familiar with some of the head-mounted displays that people use. Those are becoming increasingly common. I think from a clinical perspective, those will probably be the direction that some of the research takes off. But in our exploring the sensory information, it's actually easier to use a cave because a person can walk in and we can put them in any location, but they don't have something actually on their head. So particularly for some of the patient populations, it's a little uncomfortable, or, you know, the system's heavy, and while they're trying to move.
Maybe it's not natural either.
Correct, yeah, and it's not natural. It's also challenging sometimes because they can't see, like, their legs, and people like to be able to see your legs while you walk. So the system we have now, it's a 12-foot virtual reality cave, and we have a split belt treadmill. And so what that means is that each belt can move independently. And so there's a projector, and we create all our own scenes in-house. So if we want to put somebody, you know, in a grocery store, we would create a scene for a grocery store, and it would be projected. And then one of the kind of key components is the motion capture system. So there are cameras around the cave, and they look like normal video cameras, but they work slightly differently. So they send out light, and they wait for it to reflect back. So we put reflective markers kind of typically around 60 locations across a person's body, and so we can see how their body moves. And that will allow us not only to understand their movement, but also it will allow them to interact in our virtual reality scene. So if their head moves to the right, the scene will move accordingly.
So what are some of the things that using the VR cave does to help you better understand balance? How is it kind of, what is it providing you that maybe you couldn't get otherwise?
One of the things is our ability to disturb a person's balance. So like I had mentioned earlier, we will have the scene rotate as a person walks. And it kind of gives the illusion that you're falling to one side or the other, and then we can understand how they react or respond to that to understand falls, fall risk, along those lines. The other thing we can do is we could have individuals interact with the scene. So one thing that a lot of people tend to have problems with, particularly even healthy older adults, is dual tasking. So doing two things at the same time. And so an example that I like to give, although we're not really doing it right now, but think of walking through the grocery store and you have the list in your mind and you're trying to remember what items you need to buy and look at the items, kind of visually scan the aisle while you're walking. And so that tends to be challenging for individuals, even healthy individuals. And so we can do things like that where they have some type of cognitive task that they're thinking of at the same time that they're walking.
Your lab works with Parkinson's patients and those with balance issues due to inner ear dysfunction. How is your research kind of connecting with these groups, and how might it affect them going forward?
So one of the things that we're trying to explore now are the different mechanisms that people use to balance while walking. So typically, a lot of the existing research focuses on navigation, so which direction a person is walking, which obviously vision is crucial for that. But there's also a balance component to vision. And that really hasn't been explored, particularly in patient populations. So there are three main balance components that we've kind of identified. The first being where a person puts their foot. So as they're walking, they might take a wider or a more narrow step, and that helps you balance while walking. Another thing is kind of rolling their foot, their stance foot. So while you walk, you have one foot in stance and one foot in swing, and you can kind of roll your foot in and out to help you balance as you walk. And then the third one is when you actually go to push off onto your next foot, kind of how strongly you push off. And so we are looking at how different patient populations, so for example, individuals with Parkinson's disease, modulate those balance mechanisms. And the thought is that perhaps certain populations use more of one balance mechanism than another. And if we can understand that, then we can try and develop interventions where we can either have them use more or less of a particular balance mechanism or teach them to use a particular balance mechanism if it's possible.
And in this environment, the VR environment, is it easier both to see what they're doing and also then test out those possible interventions?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So the virtual reality is a huge component of that, being able to not only test it, but also see if we can improve it. And the motion capture is the other big component to that. So without that, we wouldn't really be able to understand how the person is responding.
You also look at concussions. Tell us a little bit about how they affect balance and how you can use the VR cave to better understand what people are dealing with concussions and how to address them.
That's my project, so it's a little bit easier to speak to that. So there are a number of things that we look at. So one is acute concussion. So immediately following concussion, there are balance disturbances. One of the kind of larger issues we see is that they're more disturbed by all sensory stimuli. So if a scene is moving, they'll respond much more dramatically than someone who is not concussed. And so teaching them to kind of play around with that information and maybe downweight it a little bit so they're not relying so much on it is important in terms of a rehabilitation perspective. But the other thing that we're trying to understand is more of the persistent effects. So over time, in individuals who are recovering from concussion and then also individuals who sustain repetitive head impacts. So there are sports like football. Sure, concussions occur, but there are a lot of head impacts that don't result in acute concussion. And so how those present. And so one of the things we're finding, particularly in soccer players, which is the current project we're looking at, so a lot of people think repetitive head impacts are bad, which they may or may not be. That's still not totally understood. But there's a difference in balance between people following just a series of repetitive head impacts and concussion. So the repetitive head impacts tend to cause people to downweight their vestibular information, which might not be a bad thing. So your vestibular system is the balance system in your inner ear, and it works kind of like a pair of accelerometers. There are accelerometers in your cell phone, so if you turn the orientation of your cell phone, it matches, right? Well, the vestibular system does the same thing. It tells your eyes and your body how to adjust with the movement of your head. And so the vestibular system is designed to operate during standing and walking and fairly slow movements. And so if you think about heading a soccer ball, you have a really high acceleration in the head, right? And so what these athletes tend to be doing is they downweight that vestibular information and they rely more on their vision and their proprioception, which may actually be somewhat protective. I hate to say that because it's too early to know, but the idea being that their visual information is probably more reliable because they're not having a huge, the acceleration is quite high. compared to following concussion, where they're just more disturbed all around. So those two things are presenting somewhat differently.
How useful is studying the sports aspect of it, both just in, you know, kind of regular activity like heading a ball, and concussed sports athletes, helpful in figuring out how best to treat those non-athletes who have concussions?
Yeah, I think that's very important for a couple reasons. First, the sports athletes are typically very motivated to get back to sport. So when you provide some type of intervention, they're going to be, you know, extremely motivated to test that intervention to see if it works. The other thing is that there are a lot more sport-related concussions, particularly among youth athletes. So we can take some of the techniques that we can study in a larger cohort and then apply it to some of the, I mean, you know, automobile accidents and falls in older adults are very common and do result in concussion. But it's a bit easier to recruit the younger athletes and to test different rehabilitation interventions in those individuals.
Is it also interesting to be looking at younger folks and maybe looking at it in relation to brain development and how that may work?
Yeah, so one of the projects that we're working on is looking at the age of first exposure to sport. And we really haven't found anything, which is contrary to what we had expected. So we thought that individuals who started participating in sports at a younger age would potentially have more balance problems, but that doesn't appear to be the case, which is certainly a good thing. And I think it also has a pretty big social, like a societal implication, because a lot of sports now are trying to limit participation for youth athletes. But in our collegiate athletes, we don't appear to be seeing any differences between people who start, for example, before age 12 compared to after age 12. And, you know, that's not to say that later life impairments don't develop. It's certainly possible, but from the data that we have a bit available right now, it doesn't seem like that makes a difference.
That might have some implications for parents who are worried about starting their kids in sports young, or even sports like soccer, where I know coaching you soccer, they try to discourage heading the ball when you're younger because they think that might be a good idea.
Yeah, right. So it's definitely too early to say definitively one way or another, but I can say that in all the data we have available to us, it doesn't seem to make a difference whether, you know, you start playing soccer and heading the ball at age 10 versus 14.
What other projects do you foresee this lab working on in the future?
So one of the projects that I'm hoping to get started shortly is looking at some of the later life effects following concussion and repetitive head impact in sport. So for example, recruiting 50 to 70 year old or even older individuals who have a history of concussion or, you know, played football or soccer during their youth or adolescence, and looking at some of those later life effects that I had alluded to earlier. Another project, again, is kind of looking at the balance mechanisms in older adults, people with Parkinson's, and children with cerebral palsy. I know the children with cerebral palsy is a project that we're getting started on pretty soon. And then probably one project kind of down the line is looking at individuals following stroke. There's so much stroke research at the University of Delaware, so there would be a lot of potential for collaboration there too.
And finally, I mean, you know, as this technology develops, is there kind of a, you know, for you kind of a dream scenario where like hey, we could really study X or Y once we kind of have this technology, even like going, having the ability to use the headsets maybe a little bit more. Do you see some like real implications maybe further down the road for what you're doing here?
Yeah, I think one of the big things I had alluded to earlier was the dual tasking. And I think there's a lot of potential for rehabilitation using dual task interventions. So if we know that, you know, an older adult, for example, is going to struggle, the example I gave earlier was grocery shopping, right? Then we can put them in a safe environment where they're in a harness and they can explore the boundaries of their balance and cognition and have them practice there so that now when they go out into the community, they feel more comfortable and more confident doing some of those dual task activities.
Thanks to UD postdoctoral researcher Jacqueline Cassis for inviting us to the Control of Balance and Locomotion Lab at the University of Delaware's Star Campus and its VR Cave. And remember, you can check out our intern contributor DJ McCauley's story on the VR Cave right now at DelawarePublic.org. And the Green continues in a moment with another edition of Arts Playlist, featuring the Rehoboth Art League and its efforts to highlight the importance of art preservation. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. In recognition of Preservation Month in May, the Rehoboth Art League presents Preservation Matters later this month. The League's exhibitions director, Nick Serator, says it's extremely important that items like paintings and paper documents in particular are preserved properly. And Serator says there is a process to correcting fading works and rebuilding missing pieces of documents. In our latest Arts Playlist, Serator chats with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about how Preservation Matters, opening May 10th, uses the Rehoboth Art League's permanent collection to highlight and bolster the group's preservation efforts.
What's this all about?
Well, the Rehoboth Art League has several committees, different committees that oversee certain functions of the organization. One of these committees is known as the Collections Committee. The collection committee oversees the permanent collection. The permanent collection is artwork that is owned by the Rehoboth Art League. It has probably over 800 items in it. Predominantly is paintings, works on paper, documents, scrapbooks, memorabilia from the history of the Art League. A lot of it dates back to 1938 and beyond that. And what the collections committee has to do up until around in 2015, let me just backtrack real quickly. In 2015, one of the buildings was completely gutted and remodeled on the same footprint. And this building houses the permanent collection. It has state-of-the-art lighting, temperature control to preserve the art. Unfortunately, up until that time, for decades, the work was stored in an upstairs, basically it was like an attic of the homestead, and the homestead is the original structure on the property that dates back to 1732. So during this time, a lot of the work has been affected by the humidity, works have been deteriorating, and these works have been identified by this collections committee within the past 10 years of needing conservation and quickly. So Preservation Matters started last year. May is Preservation Month. And what the idea was is to highlight the works that are in need the most and put them out there for adoption. Basically, the adoption is trying to raise funds to restore these works. Last year, 8 works were put out there. They're hung. We had an event. People did adopt the works. These works have been conserved since then. They consisted of both works on canvas and on paper. And with the adoption process, the people will receive, the work is actually, when it comes back, we photograph it professionally or have it scanned. And we give those as a gift, a jaclay print of the work that was restored to the person who funded the money to have it restored.
All right. So in this permanent collection, you've already said, containing more than 700 items, about how many really need to be looked at and need some work done?
Well, the collection committee, that's what they have done. For the past 10 years, they have actually documented every item that was in there. So there are works that are a desperate need, but then it goes down into works that will eventually need work done, but it's not critical at this moment. Works on paper are the most critical because, unlike the canvas, the paper at that time of when the artist was using it, the materials weren't as archival as they are today. So a lot of works have deteriorated. They've become very yellowed. The paper has become very brittle. Pieces are missing. Corners are torn. And so the conservation restores these. It's more painstaking to do the works on paper and much more costly than preserving our work on cannabis.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. All right, we're talking about, in recognition of Preservation Month in May, the Rehoboth Art League is going to be presenting Preservation Matters. It goes from May the 10th through June the 9th. Now, as a supplement to the exhibition, there's also going to be a gallery talk. Tell us when, where, and what that's going to consist of.
Okay, on Saturday, on the May 11th at 2 p.m., one of our conservators from Washington, D.C., her name is Im Chan, and Im works strictly with paper. She's the conservator for Smithsonian, the National Portrait Gallery. So when we are doing works on the paper to have it restored, we send them to her. So she will be here to talk about the process, the importance of preservation, and basically give us a history on the materials that are have been used and what are used today. It's very informative. So if anyone has work in their homes or any kind of collection that need information on how to restore it, this is open to the public, and we encourage everyone to come and see this and to listen.
Where can people get more information about Preservation Matters?
Definitely on our website, www.rehobothartleague.org. It's in a list of upcoming attractions, and also it just explains basically all the gallery talks that we have for the year from various artists.
And for people who aren't familiar, Nick, talk to us about the Rehoboth Art League. Give us some background.
Well, we're celebrating 81 years. It started in 1938. Colonel William Corcoran and his wife Louise had bought the Peter Marsh House, which is known as the Homestead. And back that time, it was just a giant farm, and it was like really the only structure in Hennepin Acres. Corcoran's had developed it. William Corcoran was an architect that came from New Jersey. He developed the Hennepin Acres, probably one of the first developments. But Miss Corcoran, she had a love of arts. She had some friends that were very prominent in the art world. One of them is Ethel P.B. Leach. She known Jack Lewis, Howard Schroeder, you know, notable artists from Delaware. And what these people did, Louise opened her house as like a summer place for her friends to come and paint. Eventually, Colonel Corcoran put some additional buildings on the property, and one of them, the painter studio, which is a tiny little building here that was actually brought down on the Lewis Rehoboth Canal and hauled up by hand, became the Art League. It was like this building became the gathering place. And from there, it just took off, and it just grew bigger and bigger and became quite an institution down here and formed into a nonprofit organization.
And really, it's right in our backyard.
It's right in the backyard. It's open year-round. We have exhibitions throughout the year. We have classes throughout the year. And just, you know, we're heavily involved with the community and the arts. So I encourage people to check us out.
All right, Preservation Matters on display from May the 10th through June the 9th. It's meant to highlight treasures from the League's, from the Rehoboth Art League's esteemed permanent collection. There's going to be an opening reception on Friday, May the 10th from 5 until 7. Is that open for everyone?
That is open to the public. And also, with the Preservation Matters, it'll be a treat to see the works. We have images before the restoration and, of course, the actual restored piece will be hanging on the wall. During that night also, we have several other exhibitions opening. We have a show called Voyages with the works from Sharon Strine and Carolyn Huff from the Corcoran Gallery. Our Tubbs Gallery is featuring work from the Coastal Camera Club. And in the Homestead, we have a juried member showcase called Secret Places.
And all of these events and exhibitions are free and open to the public, right?
That is correct.
Anything else about Preservation Matters that you want to get out to the general public?
Well, you know, I think everyone has scrapbooks and they have memorabilia, just probably works on paper or canvases that are very much part of the family treasures. And, you know, don't think of it as something that's going to cost like a ton of money to restore. Get information on it. I guess the talk on Saturday, May 11th with M. Chan, will be very informative. But there are people pretty much, you know, within not too far distance that can help you out and put you in the right direction to restore works that are valuable to you. and also that it gives you a good history, and also it's very informative on what to do and what not to do, because people have a tendency sometimes to just say, I can fix this myself, and not really knowing the outcome that it could cause, probably most likely in a negative way, too.
Thanks to the Rehoboth Art League's Exhibitions Director, Nick Serator, and R. Kelly Steele for joining us for this edition of Arts Playlist. And a reminder, the Rehoboth Art League's Preservation Matters opens May 10th and runs through June 9th. You can find more information about it at rehobothartleague.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagnast, intern contributor DJ McCauley, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.